This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Anything that's ever been alive should be treated as a resource versus put in a landfill.
Today on Sea Change Radio, I talk with two people working on very different fronts of the environmental movement. My first guest is Dale Wannan, who runs a sustainable and responsible investment firm. We discuss the latest in sustainable and responsible investment, or SRI, including whether or not the small investor stands a chance in the age of flash trading. He also explains how owning just a small amount of stock allows an investor to influence a corporation's sustainability practices, creating a return that's both monetary and socially beneficial. Then I talk to composting expert Gail Luz. She tells us about the growing trend among municipalities to encourage composting through curbside pickup programs. She also describes how to get a return on your biodegradable garbage in the form of nutrient-rich soil, even if your city's not yet composting. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Dale Wannan. He's president of Sustain Invest Asset Management. Dale, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
We've done several pieces in the past on Sea Change Radio on sustainable investing, and a lot of our listeners may be familiar with the term SRI, socially responsible investing. Why don't you first give us a little update on where the trends have been moving in this industry in the last year or so?
Well, yeah, the first thing people generally ask me is like, what does SRI even stand for? And so the actual word is sustainable and responsible investing, what was formerly called socially responsible investing. But I think it's interesting, the industry, people were saying, well, are you doing environmentally conscious stuff as well? And we are, of course, so that's sort of why it wasn't just socially responsible. As far as the trends, ESG screening, and when I say ESG screening, that stands for another acronym, is environmental, social, and governance. Those are really the three screening mechanisms that are used when it comes to looking for companies to invest in. That's one of the components. Another component that seems to be catching a lot of interest is shareholder activism, which I think we'll delve into a little bit later. And then the last one, and certainly not least, is impact investing, formerly called community investing, but this word impact is being thrown around a lot, and hopefully we'll touch base on that a little bit.
So a lot of people who have been hesitant to get into the investing world have been trepidatious because a lot of the news sounds like the deck is stacked against the small investor. What is the sustainable and responsible investment community doing to kind of thwart that?
So there's a couple components to that. I think when you mention small investor, which most of us are, you know, we're not all multi-billion dollar hedge funds, we're seeing quite a big increase in the amount of socially screened mutual funds that are being offered. And I think that's generally the way that most investors are sort of getting into the market, is through these mutual funds or ETFs. If you would have went back 10 years, there may have been a few dozen, you know, Calvert comes to mind as sort of the large fund family. But now that offering is, there's probably over 300 mutual funds that integrate these SRI principles into them. So that's definitely one component. Another component is shareholder activism.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so if you just own $2,000 worth of one stock and you've held that for 1 year, you literally have the ability or the legal right to file something called a shareholder resolution, which allows you to simply address any company or a company you own on an issue that you feel as if they may not be handling the right way.
Well, how does that differ from a nasty letter to the CEO or vice president of marketing? What kind of leverage does a shareholder have when they launch an activist campaign? And maybe give us an example of one.
Absolutely. Of course, you have the right to write a letter, a nasty letter to the CEO if you want to, and I'm sure that's, they'll receive it just as well. But this is more of an organized manner first off, you own shares of stock in the company. And once the executives or the corporate counsel or the board sees that you're an owner in this company, they tend to listen a little bit more as a shareholder. On top of that, this proclamation or this resolution that you introduce to them can actually get on something called the proxy statement, which is a statement, and a lot of us probably get them in the mail and don't read them. It's a black and white sort of plain vanilla statement, but every single shareholder gets it. And so your resolution will be seen by literally millions of people, and you can, the shareholders can vote yes or no in favor of that resolution. So it's sort of a more organized, or it is a more organized manner of addressing a company with an issue that they may not be handling as well.
Do you have any guarantee as a shareholder who's owned $2,000 worth of this stock for a year that at the annual meeting your issue will be heard? Is there any kind of standardization in terms of how much your voice is heard?
Yes. So there is, behind all this, there is definitely an organized process. If your resolution does get put onto the proxy statement, which we referred to before, and the SEC makes the final judgment as to whether it gets accepted onto the proxy statement, if it does get put on, you are actually given about 5 minutes to go up in front of the board and the executives at their annual shareholder meeting. And that gives you time to discuss your resolution in front of the CEO, the board of directors. And they all are different. I mean, I've been to the Apple shareholder meeting where there's 300 plus people and press all over the place. And that's a great place to sort of voice concern because there's a lot of people listening. And I've also been to some companies' shareholder meetings where there's the board of directors and three shareholders. Regardless, you're standing in front of the people who are making decisions, and that's the executives. And so, and then it's voted on by the shareholders.
At an Apple shareholder meeting, are there dozens of these people waiting to have their turn, or is it just a few?
For Apple, it's just a few. It all depends on the company. Apple, I would say last year they may have had three or four shareholder resolutions on the ballot. If you go to a company like Chevron or Monsanto, you'll see closer to 8 or 9 shareholder resolutions. And I've been to both of those meetings, and I have to say Chevron is sort of, it's a very interesting, I don't want to call it a circus, but security is very high there. There's literally a line out the door of people who want to speak directly to the CEO of the company because of the issues that they've been involved in.
Well, it's in the Bay Area too, right?
That's correct.
And yeah, they have their Richmond refinery, which is definitely rankled more than a few people in the East Bay community, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So give us an example of some of the most effective shareholder advocacy and activism over the last decade that might come to mind.
There's a lot of different issues out there. I could pinpoint a few examples. Like I think of Denny's. I think a lot of us know Denny's, which is the breakfast place I haven't been to in years, but a small shareholder addressed them and said, hey, are you using any cage-free eggs in your facilities? And the answer was no. And so it was because of the power of this single shareholder that they got their resolution put on the ballot. I think it received a little bit less than 10% of a yes vote. That may seem small, but that's actually huge because the CEO and the board of directors, when they see a 7% yes vote in favor of a resolution, you better be darn well sure that they're going to pay attention to it. And so
so it's not a majority kind of issue.
It's not. As a matter of fact, most of these resolutions don't get a majority vote.
It's kind of just a squeaky wheel.
It is, exactly. And now Denny's, I've read recently that they've implemented, I think it's up to 5% of their eggs are now cage-free certified, which, again, doesn't seem like much, but I think Denny's is probably one of the biggest purchasers of eggs in the country. And so to make that small incremental movement to lead to positive change is great. And there's a number of examples. I think political contributions for 2013 was the number one issue. Super PACs and the Colbert Report and all these media, influential media people are, of course, sort of, it's a hot press topic. And so that leads to a lot of these filers out there to sort of hone in on what is the hot topic. And political contributions has definitely been the top issue for the past year or two. Environmental proposals are always probably second or third up there. And then you have special interests. You have organizations like PETA, who file about a dozen of these every year in favor or asking companies to address their animal cruelty issues. So there's issues that are sort of, it's not so complicated. Some of them are corporate governance, where they want to separate the chairperson role from the CEO role. So some of them can get a little more not so sexy as far as corporate governance goes, but other ones, and I bring that up because I feel like individual shareholders shouldn't feel intimidated because they don't know some bylaw chapter amendments of a corporation. I mean, think of something that's really near and dear to your heart and then start to do the research from there. And you'll see that there's resolutions out there that may fit what you're sort of trying to go after yourself.
Money. You've got lots of friends crowding round the door. When you're gone and the spending ends, they don't come. Rich relations give crusts of bread and such. You can help yourself, but don't take too much. Mama may have.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Dale Wannan. He's the president of Sustain Invest Asset Management. So what kind of impact in general do you think that sustainable and responsible investing is having, Dale?
So when people say, do you think you're having an impact by aligning clients' dollars in the publicly traded market or the secondary market? I always say yes. I feel like if you can divest of a company, and I keep using Monsanto or Exxon or some of the big banks, that's your power of saying, I don't want to invest in your company. Granted, you as an individual may not have a huge impact on the value of that stock, but say, for instance, we were able to get 10% of all stockholders of Exxon to divest. You better darn believe that the value of that stock is going to drop. And what that does is, and this again ties back to why it's important to think about what you have invested in the stock market, regardless, it lowers the market capitalization of that company. And in turn, that actually will lower the amount of money that that company can borrow or leverage against. So I do feel as if these divestment campaigns and these ESG screening devices that are being used to not invest in companies is a very powerful way to affect the value of a publicly traded company.
One of the things that we've seen in the last few years are causes going online causes. Sign this petition, either through Facebook and other social media vehicles. How do these kind of petitions stack up against what we're talking about here in terms of shareholder activism? Or can they work hand in hand?
Yeah, I think they can work hand in hand, Alex. I think you look at an organization like change.org that's creating some incredible movements. I'm still waiting to hear of a shareholder resolution that gets put on to change.org's sort of platform to see if it gets put forth a little bit further. There are some organizations that have actually attempted to address this. Moxie Vote is one that comes to mind. I don't know if they're in business anymore, but it's something definitely that you may want to check out. And there's organization called proxyvote.org as well. So there's definitely certain organizations that are attempting to address this issue. But again, I almost feel like it hasn't been given this sexy appeal to it again. And that's why investors aren't resonating with it. But once they realize that they may be able to change a multi-billion dollar organization on a certain topic or issue, I think it's only a matter of time where this will become just more of a hot topic.
In the beginning of our discussion, Dale, I asked you about the small investor and how he or she can feel like they have a fighting chance. You said that mutual funds are proliferating and offering more and more responsible investment options for investors. But one thing that we're becoming more and more aware of is flash trading. First, explain what flash trading is and why this is a concern for small investors and even mutual funds that are involved in the SRI industry.
With the recent Michael Lewis's recent book, Flash Boys, this is definitely garnering a lot of attention and much deserved. You know, you look at the history of people who have held stock. I think the average investor now holds a stock for about 8 months. We'll get back to flash trading in a second, but I think this is an important point. In the 50s and 60s, individual stockholders were holding stocks for about 8 years. So we've gone from this 8 year period of owning a stock to about 8 months. And there's a lot of reasons behind this. One, of course, is flash trading. Flash trading is really, in a nutshell, is sort of the larger investors and big investors who have the ability to trade pennies of a stock price and to be able to get in and out without sort of this transparency behind it. And I definitely think there's some major concerns here. One is maybe they should be taxed at a higher rate if they're going to be doing this. You know, flash trading, how about flash taxing? Something along the lines of that.
What would a flash tax be?
If a stock is held for over a year right now, the capital gains rate is 20%, meaning that any gains as an individual you make in that stock, you have to pay tax on it, of course. With anything less than a year, it's actually closer to the mid-30s, or it's taxed at an income tax rate, and I'm not a tax advisor, but so clearly there's a benefit to holding onto a stock for over a year. But with the flash trading, they're saying, well, we are willing to pay the tax, the short-term tax, whatever is under a year. But what I'm saying is, well, let's up that tax rate. You know, why not put it closer to 50 or 60%? If these individuals are going to manipulate the market the way they're doing it, then they should maybe pay taxes for doing so. But I think overarching and with my firm, I don't pay much attention to this. And this is because when I look to invest in a company, I really look at what they're considering for the long term. You know, when I look at Whole Foods Market or I look at Chipotle, I want to see not only fiscally what they're doing, but also what are the long-term sustainability issues that they're addressing? Are they addressing their carbon output? Are they addressing minority representation on the board or women representation as executives? And so for my investors, and I think for most people out there who dabble in trading, I think there's going to be a lot of people who oppose what I'm saying, but I don't know how much of an effect this is having on the long-term value of a mutual fund or a stock price. And I don't think any of us know what the future holds with the market now being, you know, about 50% of all volume is now done through flash trading. But what I really hope is that regardless of people getting in and out of these stocks every second, in the long term, if a company is handling their business correctly and increasing their revenues year over year if they can, and at the same time addressing sustainability, I feel like flash traders can take it or leave it.
But still, I think one of the problems is, like what you said, is that we don't really know. And that's one of the things that keeps people on the sidelines.
I'm just basing my notes and my thoughts here off of just history. And I think if you look at the history of the stock market and of a company like Johnson & Johnson, or you could look at any company, Apple or Google, which I guess are considered sort of the grandfathers of technology now. I think if you look at the historical numbers and for people who want to put money away and get a decent return, I feel like the stock market is an okay place to be. Granted, I also feel like you need to be diversified into other asset classes, which may include impact investing. But if you look at the long-term history of returns on stocks and bonds and even real estate for that matter, you'll see that if there was a better place to put your money, I think people would be doing it. But at this point, I feel like it's as if it's still one of our best places to put assets for the long term.
Dale Wannan, he's the president of Sustain Invest Asset Management. Dale, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Waste that one, not pick it up. Waste that one, not pick it up. Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
Next on Sea Change Radio, I'm joined by composting expert Gail Luz. Gail, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hello, Alex. Nice to talk to you.
Why don't you first tell our listeners what makes you a composting expert? You've been doing this for over 2 decades now, right?
Yep, I've been composting pretty much my whole life, which is a little more than 2 decades, but I've really focused on it in the last 20 years in my own home, and I started teaching food scrap recycling about 10 years ago.
And where do you live?
I live in Denver.
And Denver does not have municipal-wide composting yet, or does it?
We have where you can opt in. That just went active this spring. We had done a test a couple years ago with not very many households participating, and we just launched it again this spring.
So what does somebody like you, who lives in a city where does not have a mature composting infrastructure in place, what do to try to mitigate your food and yard waste?
I am composting my backyard, so I put out every single thing that was ever alive from my kitchen or my home, whether it's a piece of tissue or a dust bunny, and I compost it.
How?
I use a number of ways. I have a large compost pile, but most food scraps I just bury right in my garden, just to get them back into the cycle more quickly.
And how long does it usually take for your average pile to decompose?
Food scraps, if you shred them ahead of time and have a bioactive soil already with lots of worms, it takes about a week before you're ready to plant there.
Really? Speaking of shredding, you have an invention that shreds food to kind of accelerate this composting. Why don't you tell our listeners about it?
Living in Colorado, where it's very cold in the winter and dry all the time, I would put something in my compost pile and come back 6 months later and it'd be still sitting there exactly the same as when I put it in the pile. So I did some research and found that the ideal situation for composting is to create 1/2 by 1/2 inch pieces so there's more surface exposed to the microbes. So I went looking for a product. Nothing existed, so I invented something we call the Green Cycler. It's a compost shredder that makes compost happen really quickly.
Is it a hand composter, or do you plug it in? And about how much food waste can it really handle?
So what you do is you put your food waste in the top. You shred it by hand. There's no plug connected. And you can store about a week's worth before you need to put it out into your composter, barrel, or community garden. So it's just an ongoing process. You keep the Green Cycler or the compost shredder in your kitchen, and you just constantly shred up your food scraps and paper towels and coffee filters and all that stuff.
What are some of the foods that don't compost well?
Well, anything that's ever been alive composts. It's whether you want to put bones and meat scraps and that sort of thing in your garden. The problem is that it attracts pests, not that it won't compost. Sort of a misunderstanding in the general public that you can't compost meat. It's just that you don't want really the raccoons to do the job for you.
Now let's turn to some of the more large-scale composting, if you will. New York City is kind of right in the midst of kicking in its composting program, correct?
Yes. Bloomberg announced before he left the job that he was going to launch full-scale composting, or was urging the city to do it. And they are testing it now in Brooklyn. And there's different areas around the city, different parts of the boroughs that are trying it simply because they don't have space to put all of their food and food-related waste.
Why are some cities not composting when it makes so much sense?
I would say the main thing that prevents composting is infrastructure. There's a lot of citizens who don't want a composting site placed near them. And there's still a lot of debate over whether waste to energy is the way to go, or just simply composting and using old-fashioned windrows, rows of compost covered up to prevent the smell is the way to go. But quite frankly, the infrastructure does not exist in most places.
There's money to be made in composting, though.
Yeah, there is definitely money to be made. It costs a lot to transport wet and heavy food scraps, which is why most cities charge their citizens. For example, in Denver, you have to pay a fee about $30 a month to participate in the composting program, because they're such expensive scraps to haul, but they're hauling them anyway. So it's a little bit of a conundrum why people don't do it.
Well, Recology here in San Francisco, I know that their compost facility is around 50, 60 miles away in Vacaville. Mm-hmm. And so that's obviously a transportation cost. But once they compost that, they then can sell it to wineries in Napa and Sonoma and lots of other farmers, I imagine.
Well, yeah, they sell it right back to their citizens.
What are some of the barriers besides just the blanket term infrastructure to getting this going? And maybe you can talk about some of the cities like New York that are about to start launching their composting.
I would say the main thing and what has helped me to focus is just misunderstanding about how composting works, recycling food scraps. It's really, in my opinion, the next frontier of recycling. Years ago, none of us believed that we would take our beer bottles or pop bottles and recycle them, but now we do it as a matter, you know, as a habit. And I'm hoping, and people like me are hoping that recycling food and food soiled waste becomes the next big recycling topic. The problem is, it stinks. Nobody really wants a composting facility sited near them. And it just does. Unless it's very, very well managed, it's kind of a messy business.
But just talking about the carbon footprint of yes, it's expensive, relatively expensive to have to ship something out of your, for example, in San Francisco, to ship it 55 miles to Vacaville, that might be an expense, but it's nothing compared to the vast web of recycling that goes on internationally, right? A lot of our electronics and other recyclables go to China and to parts far and wide on the globe.
Right. Well, and the United States is far behind virtually all other countries in terms of composting and food waste recycling. We've been very blessed with land resources. So we continue to landfill what's really a resource. But Europe and other countries simply don't treat their food waste like we do, or their yard scraps, or basically anything that's ever been alive should be treated as a resource versus put in a landfill. So New York has been spending loads of resources to cart their food waste and their garbage to away from the city. Whereas if they put some investment in the infrastructure, again, the infrastructure to compost, they can keep it all right there in a very small space and make a significant improvement, not just in the cost of waste disposal, but they can then use the resulting product in their, you know, Central Park and put it back to work. And they're already paying for fertilizers and other things that is a whole other issue with water quality and the related issues of chemicals and pesticides that really can be cured with compost as a product.
Her product is greencycler.com. She's composting expert Gail Luz. Gail, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome, Alex. Keep it green.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Mark Morrison, Harry Belafonte, and The Pretenders. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidioedu.org. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.